There is an amazing number of people who believe in God. They're religious. They may go to church. And many of them also believe in angels and answered prayer. There have been some surveys recently that showed a surprising number of people that believe in those things. And yet many of these religious people also believe in evolution. A term I believed, or that I learned many years ago, is theistic evolution. Theistic evolution. This approach requires that you believe part of the Bible, but reject other parts. At least that is really what it boils down to. One part that would have to be rejected or described as entirely allegorical or in some way dismissed is Genesis chapter 1. I'd like to read verses 21 through 25. Genesis 1 in the book of beginnings. Verse 21, so God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded according to their kind. Now I'm emphasizing this phrase, according to their kind. And every winged bird according to its kind. God was creating kinds of creatures, and God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. So the evening and the morning were the fifth day. Verse 24, then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. For evolution to be true, there has to be a crossover from one kind to another. Otherwise, evolution could not have taken place. Many of the claims of evolution are that one kind developed into another kind. I'll have a lot more to say about that as we go. Now, whereas the Bible is not a full-blown detailed science book in one sense, it gives basic principles and sets them forth, and those principles are inviolable and they're significant. And they do disprove evolution. There are primary proofs that evolution is false and creation is true. Now I realize I don't have to convince you that God exists and that evolution is false. I don't have to convince you not to be a theistic evolutionist. On the other hand, we need to, as we say in the vernacular, know our stuff. Now, we do need to be able to refute the arguments of evolution. Today I want to look at one facet of the subject, and it has several branches. The concept that I was just emphasizing of after its kind. After its kind. God established creatures on this earth to reproduce after their kind, not after the kind of another kind. There will be some related matters we'll touch on as well. I'd like to just say a little more about theistic evolution. Now you can go to the web and find a lot of information. Wikipedia, which is not the end-all source, and yet often gives some very good information and quotes a number of other good sources. But they have a lot to say about theistic evolution, including the fact that this view of evolution and creation being compatible, say, it's generally accepted by major Christian churches. And it's true, there are major Christian churches that accept, or in part accept it, or some segments of the church accept it. One is the Roman Catholic Church, also the Eastern Orthodox Church, and some mainline Protestant denominations, virtually all Jewish denominations, and other religious groups. that do not have a literal interpretation or stance toward the Bible. They look at many of the scriptures as allegorical. The stories about creation are described as allegorical in nature. They picture something else. And interestingly, even St. Augustine, clear back in the 4th century, thought this way. He, originally, and earlier on in his life, he decided that scriptures like Genesis 1 were allegorical. Then he changed his mind and said, well, no, they're literal, but the terms are spiritual. When St. Augustine came to believe that where it says day, it's talking about a spiritual day. When it talks about morning, it's talking about a spiritual morning in a literal sense, whatever that means. So we find great logic in some of these approaches that people have. Of course, St. Augustine had a number of other problems. Well, is the Bible literal or is it allegorical? There are allegories in the Bible, but they're easy to identify. Clearly allegories, but when something is stated in a very literal way, that's what it is. It is literal. If you use this approach and how you approach the Bible, how can you really use the Bible as a guidebook for life? You can't. Because you'd say, well, I don't want to obey that because it's just allegorical. When it says, don't commit adultery, that means spiritual adultery, meaning I should not go attend other churches. And the way you reason would know no bounds. And you'd end up doing some of the things that we heard about Buddhism, I suppose. Theistic evolution is also called evolutionary creation, is a concept that asserts that classical religious teachings about God are compatible with the modern scientific understanding about biological evolution. There's no conflict between modern scientific understanding about evolution and the Bible. This is what they say. They take the stance that biological evolution is simply a natural process within the creation. Evolution is a tool that God has used and employed to develop human life and other life. Now, maybe God, some might think, just created the Big Bang. The Big Bang theory we've heard of is a theory. So they might say God instituted the Big Bang and then just let everything happen from there. So they have no problem with most of the tenets of evolution. We believe the Bible does not conflict with true science, but a lot of science is not true science, plainly put. So I wanted to say a little more about theistic evolution before we got into this. We are not theistic evolutionists, but we do believe the Bible agrees with true science. All right. Evolution demands that over a period of millions of years, many millions of years, one kind produced another kind. Now we're going to define what a kind is. They sometimes describe it as happening according to a process called punctuated equilibrium. Have you heard of punctuated equilibrium? Now, of course, a lot of these theories come and go. It's kind of hard to keep up with the latest evolutionary theory because sometimes they change. But this is one of the main ones that has been used. This is what they call it. In other words, they say this development came in spurts. It would come on strong for a while, then it would slack off. It would flow, then it would ebb. For example, one claim that is made, Birds came from reptiles. Or dinosaurs. We'll see an example of that a little later on. And of course, here's the primary one. Man came from the apes. What is a kind? In modern terminology, a kind is a genus, G-E-N-U-S. A genus, or a kind, is a group of species. Now we can illustrate that to make it clearer. This may be fundamental biology for some of you who are in or have been in school recently. But to illustrate, the dog family, or the cat family, or the bovine family, or the, and you equestrians, pardon my pronunciation, equus, if that's correct, in describing the horse family, E-Q-U-U-S. You've all heard of equine and how that's applied to horses. So you have these kinds. Again, the cat family is a kind. But within the dog family, there are a lot of animals. Wolves, coyotes, jackals, foxes, and the domestic dog. Cats. Again, we're talking about kinds here. Within the cat family, lions, tigers, domestic cats, bobcats, leopards, panthers, cheetahs, and you could probably add several more. And the horse family, three main ones I'll mention here, domestic horses, which we know the best, wild horses, which are much like the domestic horses and can be domesticated in most cases, and donkeys and zebras. One interesting thing to me is that within a kind, there often are domestic animals and wild animals. A zebra is a wild animal. Then, we have subspecies and varieties. We have species, subspecies, and varieties. With the domestic dog species, you have fox terrier, husky, Doberman, collie, Cocker Spaniel, and there's one I've had to add to my list, Lhasa Apso. Linda has a Lhasa Apso, or we have a Lhasa Apso, or she has us, perhaps. A variety is defined as a category within a species. A category within a species based on some hereditary differences. There are endless varieties and sub-varieties like red huskies or silver huskies, and different varieties have come about also through selective breeding. But to come back to the main point, a kind or genus only reproduces after its kind, just like God said in Genesis 1. You cannot cross the kind. Now, varieties can interbreed. When this happens with dog varieties, you end up with what we call a mongrel. One genus or kind in the Bible does not interbreed with another. They may share some traits, but that doesn't mean that they can breed with one another. We share some traits with the ape. Does that mean we came from the ape? Of course not. And a very interesting factor is humans and apes do not interbreed. You cannot, you know, breed a half ape, half human. It's not going to happen. That in itself, I believe, is a major testimony against evolution. If we came from the apes and they are our nearest relatives in the evolutionary tree, why is there no reproduction? When did it get shut off, so to speak? A man has never witnessed a violation of the God-given law that kind reproduces after its own kind. Now, there are two words often used to describe a living thing, like Lilium tigrinum, or tigrinum, however that's pronounced, tiger lily. The Lilium is the genus, the tigrinum is the species. Now, when species, which come below kind or genus, when they breed together, which sometimes can be done, sterility is generally the result. So you have this genus of the equus or horse kind, and you have donkeys, and you have zebras. So there can be, to an extent, some interbreeding done between these species. Again, the next category under the genus. What you have when that happens is a hybrid, called a hybrid. Good example, the mule. I'm not saying anyone here is like a mule. Don't interpret anything that way. Mule is the offspring of a male donkey or ass, and I, in one sense, hesitate to use that. That is a valid term, but that term has come to have such a terrible meaning, a vulgar meaning today in the way it's used. But a donkey and a female horse, male donkey and female horse. Sometimes the female is fertile. But if she has offspring, it will be a horse. Male mules are completely sterile. So when you take the species and interbreed them, you get varying results, but it's not a normal kind of reproduction. So the female mule would have to be mated with a horse. So even between two species, there is somewhat of a barrier. But there's much more of a barrier between the genera. Genera is plural of genus, or kinds. Much more of a barrier that man has not broken between the kinds. You also can have a, and this is more rare, but a male horse and a female donkey producing a henny, and that's not considered as desirable an animal as a mule. A mule is a good work animal, has some very good traits. So they are hybrids that are bred. But the question arises, can a zebra be interbred with another species in the horse or equus family? It's interesting because within the various kinds of genera, as I said, there are domestic species and wild species, zebra being wild, horse being, for the most part, domestic or potentially domestic, as with the wild horses. And obviously, a zebra is a wild animal, but it can be bred in a few different combinations with horses and donkeys. The general term for the hybrid that is produced is zebroid, but there are other more specific terms depending on what combination you use to bring about the hybrid. Then you have, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Another thing I see is that similar anatomy or features are not the criterion. It's not an indication that reproduction can occur. It simply is not. Let's turn to Genesis 7. Genesis 7 now, verse 12. Genesis 7, verse 12. The rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and Noah's son, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind. So now we come down to the flood, and it is the various kinds that are being taken into the ark. All cattle, bovine, animals after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, every bird of every sort. They went into the ark to Noah, two by two, of all flesh in which is the breath of life, male and female of all flesh, verse 16, went in as God had commanded them. God put it in their brains or their instinct to do it, and the Lord shut him in. So the waters prevailed, and everything died that was left behind. And verse 23, God destroyed all living things which were on the face of the earth, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Of course, they took seven pairs of the kinds of animals that were clean. Seven pairs of the clean and just two or one pair of the unclean. So again, we find that everything is operating on this principle God established according to kinds. They went into the ark, and then afterward were able to produce the varieties that we see today. Was there just one bovine kind? I would suppose that there was more than one. I have some doubt that the zebra came from a single parent of the horse kind, but so there may have been zebras, donkeys, and horses separate. Bible's not just real clear about that. Mutations. Some people think, well, mutations show that evolution is true. No, mutations do not show that. A calf with two heads is a donkey? Something else of a different kind? No, a calf with two heads is still a calf. A man with six fingers is an ape? No, a man with six fingers is still a man. And there were giants in the Old Testament, back in the book of Genesis, that had six fingers. So a mutation is never from one genus or kind to another. Does nothing to prove evolution. I don't think evolutionists particularly pursue that line of thought anymore. Now, even varieties do not always readily interbreed. So genus, species, varieties. Trout is a species of fish, and one that I happen to enjoy in several different ways, especially catching and especially eating. But watching as well. I even enjoy watching trout in a stream. So varieties within the trout species do not always readily interbreed. But to some extent they do. By trout, we have the varieties of rainbow, brook, brown, cutthroat, golden trout. And that's still on my list of things to do, catch a golden trout. Been looking online at some lakes up in the Snowy Range that purportedly have golden trout. But I also read where someone went there and didn't catch any. So if they're there, they might not be too easy to catch. Palomino is a less known variety of trout. Mackinaw, or lake trout, pretty well known. A lot of them here in Colorado, and a few others too. I'm not covering all of them. You'll often find these some of these varieties of trout in the same stream. For example, in the Yampa River near Steamboat Springs, I've caught about four varieties of trout fishing there at different times, mostly during feast time. And they'll generally maintain a purity of the variety, but not altogether. Sometimes the varieties of trout interbreed or are interbred by man, meaning they take the eggs from one variety They take the sperm from another and they milk it onto the eggs, and then hatchery raise the trout. So can happen naturally, the interbreeding, and other times it is induced by man. A cutbow is a cross between a cutthroat and a rainbow, and that can happen naturally, and sometimes it is induced by man as well. Then there's the tiger trout. A tiger trout is a hybrid, which does not reproduce in this case, and that's made by fertilizing female brown trout eggs with male brook trout sperm. They're sterile hybrids. So some fish will interbreed within the varieties, or between the varieties rather, or can be interbred. Same is true of some animals. Now, back in 1971, I had an opportunity to hunt in a great area of West Texas, which was right in the general vicinity of where the white-tailed deer cease to occupy the land and the mule deer take over. There's a kind of a crossover line there. There are more whitetail in Texas, and they're generally in the hill country and other parts of Texas, but millions of them in the hill country. And then over around Sanderson, you begin to get into the range of the mule deer. So on this hunt, two of us actually bagged a cross between a whitetail and a mule deer. And they did look a little different than either one, but showed some of the same features. I still have the antlers from this one deer. Actually, there was one horn that was broken off, leaving a stub that long on the one side. So this can happen in nature as well, but generally the varieties keep to themselves, but not strictly. There's no record of amphibians turning into land animals, or fish into amphibians, or reptiles into birds, or some of the other leaps that evolution talks about. Adaptation. Animals adapt, but they don't become something else. Elk, for example. I guess you can tell I'm a hunter because of the, and fisherman because of the examples I use. But elk used to be a creature of the Great Plains, according to the records. And pressure from man drove them into the mountains. But you can still find elk in a few areas of the Great Plains in smaller numbers. For example, in southeast Colorado, there are a few units that are listed in the Division of Wildlife hunting book that offer an elk tag. Probably on private land primarily, but elk can certainly live in the plains. Are elk in a zoo something different than elk? No, they're still elk. An elk is an elk is an elk regardless of what adaptation has taken place. Adaptation is not the same as Lamarck's theory. He's an evolutionist from some time ago. Lamarck thought giraffes used to have short necks, but gradually stretched them to reach the higher leaves during drought. The offspring retained these acquired characteristics. This was his theory. But never fear, Darwin didn't agree with Lamarck, so Darwin is the all-time great authority, right? Well, even modern evolutionists are saying that he did not know a lot of things. But just to illustrate something here, to say that the giraffes stretch their necks over time is like saying, or like talking about Jewish babies for the last 3,500 years. They have been circumcised so long that now they're born circumcised. Well, Darwin, and maybe in this case rightfully so, ridiculed Lamarck. He believed in natural selection, and survival of the fittest. Only the long-necked giraffes, the ones that happened to be long-necked, lived. And over time, the ones with longer necks passed on these genes to their offspring. Of course, that also means that if you have a husband with brown hair and a wife with brown hair, they could never produce an offspring or a baby with red or blonde hair, right? Well, that's wrong. And I don't know all the combinations there, but we have these things called recessive genes that skip generations and show up, and there are all kinds of possibilities there. So the only trouble, too, is what happened to the horses and zebras and others sharing the same territory with the zebras. Did they die out since they did not develop long necks? Obviously, they did not. I want to say something about instinct as well. This does not relate strongly in one sense to what the main subject is, but to me this is an amazing thing. It does have to do with or relates to adaptation, and perhaps relates to after its kind in the sense that salmon reproduce salmon. But I'm talking about the migratory aspects of salmon. How and why do they return consistently to their place of birth? What they do is one of the most amazing things in the creation, in my opinion. Biologists now believe they can sense, that is, the salmon can sense the difference in the water from each river or stream. You know, each water has a little different acid, alkaline content, mineral content, and so on. So tests have led them to believe this is probably how they sense what stream to go into and then which tributary to that stream, and so on. You know, how does something like that evolve? How did the salmon spawn when this had not evolved for millions of years? Now, how do things evolve for millions of years and still exist? They did an experiment in the state of Washington. They raised salmon from fertilized eggs, that is, men fertilized the eggs. They did this at hatchery ponds and let the baby salmon grow there for a little while. Then they dumped them at the appropriate stage of development in a lake. This lake was miles away from the hatchery, with nothing connecting the hatchery and the lake. So they dumped them in this lake, which emptied into a river and into the ocean. And the salmon obviously went out into the ocean. Then in the meanwhile, the salmon come in every 2 or 3 years or so, they dug a ditch from the hatchery to this lake. When the salmon returned a couple of years later, guess what happened? They came right up that ditch to the hatchery. Amazing, because they probably could sense the water from the hatchery, and they followed that. Another interesting question to me is, how did animals in the evolutionary cycle reproduce while their reproductive systems were evolving? I mean, didn't reproductive systems have to evolve too? How did that happen? Another thing, mammals nurse. What happened to offspring while the instinct to nurse was developing over eons of time? Or the mammary apparatus itself was evolving? You know, some things had to evolve immediately. How did all that happen? Is this really logical? And we're talking about brilliant men who have IQs much greater than ours, photographic memories that would put us to shame, but they have no judgment. There's a difference between being smart and having good judgment. This is not good judgment. Another factor is the law of biogenesis. Life comes only from life. They're refuting the theory of spontaneous generation. Man has not created life. Despite the cloning of stem cells, he's not created life. You can't bring something living from something dead. You know, evolutionists say that conditions were much different way back when these things happened. Well, that's a theory. That's speculative. Sure, they were different in some ways, but were the critical factors different? It's an awful lot of theorizing and use of the words possibly, probably, and maybe. Certainly evolutionists have to admit that many of their so-called facts are based on nothing but theories. The theory of evolution. It is a theory. Evolution demands that evolution is continually bringing things to a higher order. This is the approach. The truth is that things are going the other direction. They're running down. They're degenerating. And one example of that is even in radioactive elements like uranium. The half-life of uranium shows that uranium had to have a beginning. Radiation capability is not doubling, it is halving. And you can get into many more details on that subject. Now to come back a little closer to the matter of relating to kind reproducing after kind. And that is this subject we call the missing link or missing links. Evolution does not really like to use that term. They like to talk about transitional species, more to their liking. But where are the missing links, the transitional species, the intermediate species, where are they? Where are the fossils of those things? And especially, where are the intermediate species between apes and human beings? And why is it we can't reproduce, as I already mentioned, with them? We're closely related. Why could we not mate and have offspring? You can go on Wikipedia, Google any subject virtually. You can go under missing links and find a lot of theorizing, and you can find a list of so-called developments on the way to hominids, meaning human beings. And you will find the word probably used many, many times. You'll find possibly used quite a few times as well. You'll find statements that the reason they're missing, that is these transitional species, is because the fossil record is very incomplete. Yeah. And most organisms do not become fossils. Sure. However, one paleontologist suggests, and that's the word used, that the number of species known through fossils is only 1% of the species that have ever lived. Well, I have a few questions about that. How do you know that it would be only 1% of all the species that have ever lived? Unless you have seen all of the other 99%, which they haven't seen any of. How would you know? 1%, as far as I'm concerned, is nothing but a wild guess. The same man admits there are good fossil records of some types of living things, though, and vertebrates are included on the list. Last I knew, we were vertebrates. We have skeletons, bones. On the list of missing links on the hominid chart, again, you can find this under Wikipedia, you will find a number of ape-like creatures and a supposed development for the better, step-by-step, of these, although still lacking that quantum leap to man. One of the main things mentioned, and they're arranged in this way, the order of increasing brain size and certain other features. as if brain size was a significant measure of evolution taking place. I think it's a significant measure that God gave different creatures different sized brains. But you'll find a number of familiar names in there, which you've probably seen in the news or heard in discussions about evolution versus creation. But Australopithecus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, etc. And again, they're arranged in order of increasing brain size. The word possibly is used frequently. And, for example, one of them that's pretty far down the line, close to what they think is the level of hominids, is one that they say possibly was the first one to build a fire. Possibly the first one to build a fire. Now, how do you develop absolute fact on all of these possiblys and maybes? How does that work? How do you build something rock solid on the word suggests? To me, this is like saying a VW Beetle evolved into a Cadillac DeVille. And in the evolutionary string of cars, you might have a Ford Focus, a Chevrolet Malibu, a Buick LaCrosse, a Ford Crown Victoria, then finally the Cadillac DeVille. Each with a larger engine, you know, like each with a larger brain, than the previous one. Therefore, the Cadillac is a product of evolution. This is just about how logical all of this is in my book. And how can you prove a connection between these fossils, the skeletons and remains of which look like apes, and human beings? They find certain similarities. And they say that means it's intermediate. Two things have a mouth. Therefore, they're related, and one evolved from the other. This makes a great deal of sense, right? How do you prove the connection? I see no proof. Now, one example, and I think this has been around a long time, one example given of an intermediate species is an Archaeopteryx. Archaeopteryx. I can tell some of you have heard of that one. Evolutionary scientists have said it was a bird that was a lot like a dinosaur and was an intermediate link as dinosaurs evolved into birds. So first they say it's a bird. It had a lot of dinosaur-like features, and it became, and I get confused about whether we're going from dinosaur to bird or bird to dinosaur, but the gist of what I read indicates that the dinosaurs evolved into birds. That seems to be the direction of most of them. And because it had a theropod dinosaur's characteristics in a few ways, like jaws with small sharp teeth, a long bony tail, three fingers with claws, including a hyperextensible second toe, or killing toe, you know, like a raptor, and certain skeletal features. And they give a rundown of a few other similarities. Again, it's like, you know, you're related to a crocodile because it has a mouth and you have a mouth. It has sharp teeth, and how sharp are your teeth? I don't know. Probably not as sharp as a crocodile's. So, because of these similarities, they think it was intermediate. But it had feathers, wings, a lot of features like a bird. And they seemed to change their mind, was it closer to a bird or closer to a dinosaur? Now, one way or the other, they call it intermediate. Whether it's a late dinosaur or an early bird, it's intermediate, going from dinosaur to bird. There's one other slight difference with most dinosaurs. Archaeopteryx weighed in the vicinity of 2 pounds. But size seems to be no objection when it comes to the evolutionary tree. So, you know, this makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, that birds evolved from dinosaurs. But a so-called missing link that got a lot of evolutionists really excited not too long ago, in the year 2009, was a little female named Ida, I-D-A. Ida, they determined, was about 47 million years old. It was a very well-preserved, 95% preserved lemur-like creature, monkey in other words. And a man named Professor Bjorn Hurum from the Natural History Museum in Oslo, Norway, said, and I quote, "This is the first link to all humans and represents the closest thing we can get to a direct ancestor." I'll pass around one to each side and return these, please. I want you to see this thing that is the, or represents the closest thing we can get to a direct ancestor of human beings. Now I have a few other quotes here. Again, this was a 95% complete lemur monkey, described by experts as the eighth wonder of the world. This is from an article. The eighth wonder of the world. You look at it, does it look like the eighth wonder of the world to you? Or does it look like a small monkey's skeleton? The article by Alex Watt from Sky News Online says, "This transitional species finally confirms Charles Darwin's theory of evolution." Now look at that. And you ask yourself, does that confirm Charles Darwin's theory? Well, it should say fact of evolution then, shouldn't it? If it proves it, beyond the shadow of a doubt. This guy says this was somewhat like an asteroid falling down to Earth, you know, such a significant development. Sir David Attenborough said Darwin would have been thrilled to have seen the fossil and says it tells us who we are and where we came from. This is, you know, Sir David Attenborough. "This little creature is going to show us our connection," Attenborough goes on, "with the rest of the mammals." That shows our connection with the rest of the mammals. "The one that connects us directly with them. The link they would have said up to now is missing." Well, it's no longer missing. A lot of evolutionists believe that thing is the missing link. Well, why? What are the similarities? There are human-like nails instead of claws. There is just, these are just a couple of things, that, and that is in the bone structure. The shape of the talus bone in the foot is like that of humans. Humans have these things in their feet, you know, millions of generations later. So, that is what some evolutionists offer as the missing link. Does that look like could be a missing link to you? Is there not a thing here called common sense? Just because some of the features are similar, how does that prove that this connects apes and human beings or hominids? Well, this claim gives new meaning to this, the term quantum leap in my book. If this is the closest thing to a missing link that evolutionists can produce, it is a pretty sad state for men to be in who have high IQs. You will not find anything in the fossil record that is convincingly a missing link. In conclusion, Psalm 14 verse 1. You read this. I always like to read this again and again. The fool, doesn't matter how high his IQ is, has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. 10:4, Psalm 10, verse 4. The wicked in his proud countenance does not seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. And of course, this as has been pointed out in films that I think you've seen, many of you, relates to some people not wanting a set of laws imposed by a divine God to prevent them from what they want to do to seek their own pleasure. Just to put it in that fashion. Psalm 53, verses 1 through 6. We'll read the entire psalm. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt and have done abominable iniquity. There is none who does good. God looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. Every one of them is turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good, no, not one. Have the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and do not call upon God? There they are in great fear, where no fear was, for God has scattered the bones of him who encamps against you. You have put them to shame. This is going to happen to the atheists and evolutionists, because God has despised them. Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion. When God brings back the captivity of his people, let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. So allusions here to the establishment of the kingdom of God. May God hasten that kingdom when we'll no longer have to put up with pagan holidays and with the theory of evolution. I don't know exactly what will take place. I don't know where you will be or I will be at the time of the second resurrection. I don't know exactly where Jesus Christ will be at the time of the second resurrection. But it may be reasonable to conclude that at some point in time, probably fairly soon after the second resurrection, that one individual who will come up out of his tomb, which is located at Westminster Abbey, a man by the name of Charles Darwin, could have an audience with Jesus Christ. If that happens, I want to be there. I want to see Darwin look Jesus Christ in the eye and say, "You don't exist." Of course, Christ will not reveal himself in all his glory, lest Darwin go right back to the tomb. But at this time, neither Darwin nor any of the evolutionists will be able to deny the existence of God. And you and I will be so glad that we have known and have proved in our lives that the eternal God does indeed exist, and that his Son, Jesus Christ, will return and will totally refute the theory of evolution.